Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ojachowski and I'll be taking you through the next hour or so. On today's program, we will be speaking with Dr. John J. Pippin from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We're going to be speaking today about the upcoming conference that the PCRM has coming up. It's called the Animals Research and Alternatives Conference, Measuring Progress 50 Years Later. That's happening on a weekend in August, August 26th and 27th, in Washington, D.C. So we're going to be speaking with Dr. Pippin today about alternatives to animal research, as well as some issues involving animal research globally. You know, you hear in the news sometimes about animal research facilities opening up in other countries because they can't open up under the kind of regulations that exist in North America or in Europe. So we'll be speaking with Dr. Pippin about the sort of international animal research scene and get his thoughts on that, as well as his thoughts about the conference. But in the meantime, I've got a couple of announcements as well as a news story. So the first announcement coming to us courtesy of the organizers of the Toronto Veggie Pride Parade. Once again, they want to welcome you to Canada's, what they're calling Canada's first ever Veggie Pride Parade. The date has been set Saturday, June 5th at 11:30 a.m. The Toronto Veggie Pride Parade welcomes participants of all ages and walks of life to Canada's first ever Toronto Veggie Pride Parade. This includes individuals, families, leashed dogs, vegetarians, vegans, veg-friendly people, etc. They will also have community groups, nonprofit organizations, businesses, and professional performers and entertainers participating in the parade with their own banners. So please do check out the website for more info. That's www.veggieprideparade.ca, www.veggieprideparade.ca. And if you want to get more information, you can always drop on into our local vegan shop, Panacea, which is on Bloor Street, just west of Bathurst, and just west of Markham as well, on the north side. And the second announcement coming to us from some concerned citizens about the upcoming vote to change the board of the Toronto Humane Society. We're strongly encouraging you to inform yourself about the issues if you are a supporter of the Toronto Humane Society or a member and can participate in the vote on May 30th. And definitely check out the Faces of Change candidates that have come forward. They have a website, www.reformths.com. That's all one word, reformths.com. So this is quite an important vote after months and months of struggle and upheaval at the Toronto Humane Society. This is a chance for members and supporters to have their voices heard about the issues going on there. And one news story today coming to us from digitaljournal.com, somewhat related to the topics that we're going to be speaking with Dr. Pippin about. The headline is, Baboon Attack Seriously Injures Caretakers. In some circles, biomedical research on primates is a nice way to say animal torture. Two baboons held captive and experimented on in a lab in Texas, in San Antonio, fought back this week and attacked workers, seriously injuring one who needed to be hospitalized for his wounds. An animal caretaker at the Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research Center in San Antonio was rushed to University Hospital after being attacked by two baboons Monday while cleaning the cages of these primates that are used to confine baboons used for scientific research and eventually put to death. When the worker saw that two of the baboons had escaped from the holding area, he rushed to a safety containment area designed for such an incident, but before he could lock the door, one of the baboons pushed it open. Both of the baboons then charged the worker, who fell to the ground where he was repeatedly bitten and scratched. A second worker came to help. He also suffered bruises, scrapes, and cuts from the baboons, who were finally captured and returned to their cages as other workers came to their rescue, said spokesperson Joe Carney. Carney said everyone followed proper procedures, adding that this is an extremely unusual incident. Quote, we are reviewing the safety and standard operating procedures and looking for ways that this can't happen again. So, is this an isolated incident, we asked. Do animals held in captivity often fight back? Well, that depends on who you ask. The recent escape incident at the Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research is not isolated and was not unanticipated. Inspections by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in both May 2009 and February 2010, so quite recently, cited the Southwest Foundation for failing to provide animals with structurally sound enclosures to prevent them from escaping. Ian Smith, research associate in People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals Laboratory Investigations Division, has submitted a complaint in response to a recent incident at a Southwest Foundation to the United States Department of Agriculture. Smith said, quote, "This incident appears to have resulted from violations of the Animal Welfare Act and implementing regulations including failure to ensure that personnel are qualified to perform their duties and failure to adequately supervise employees and failure to ensure that primary enclosures contain the non-human primates securely. PETA are asking for a full investigation into the incident and any underlying issues and are asking for swift and decisive action if noncompliance to the Animal Welfare Act is found." In May 2009, the USDA cited the SFBR for violations of the Federal Animal Welfare Act after an inspector found significant problems in the structural integrity of the facilities that could result in an animal escape or injury. And then again in February 2010, a USDA inspection found that a rhesus monkey escaped his enclosure and gained access to an outdoor area when temperatures were below freezing and he could not get back in. The monkey was found near death the next morning and was euthanized. The USDA inspection report outlining these incidents are available in a PDF online. When asked their position on the biomedical research facility, Justin Goodman, associate director of the PETA Lab Investigations Department, replied, "The Southwest Foundation for Biomedical Research condemns thousands of intelligent, sensitive primates, including baboons, monkeys, and chimpanzees, to lives full of terror, loneliness, pain, and misery in lab environments that violate all of their natural sensibilities and literally drive them insane. The animals imprisoned at SFBR are forced to endure invasive, painful, and deadly experiments, and are treated as pieces of laboratory equipment that are disposed of when they're no longer in use. It's no surprise that these wild animals take any chance they can get to escape from their captors and resist the abuse that is inflicted on them." That, again, is a quote from PETA about the SFBR. And if you want to read more about that story, you can check out digitaljournal.com. Again, the headline is "Baboon Attack Seriously Injures Caretakers." And that is it for the news today. Just wanted to read you that one piece, sort of get the brain juices flowing, get you thinking about some of the issues that are going to be talked about later in the program. On today's program, we are speaking with Dr. John J. Pippin from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. I'm really excited to talk to him today. I'm very interested in this conference that they're holding, Alternatives to Animal Research 50 Years Later. And I'm really interested in speaking with him about some of the international issues related to animal testing. So I hope that you stick around, and I hope that you enjoy the show. If you have any questions or comments about the show, please feel free to drop us a line. Please and thank yous are always welcome to. Drop us a line at animalvoices@gmail.com. You can send all inquiries there. Or if you want to just download some programs and listen to more of what Animal Voices is all about, there are over 300 shows available online right now. Do check out our website, www.animalvoices.ca. Shows are organized in all sorts of different ways, so you can look by subject, you can look by date, or you can look by guest. We've had, like I said, hundreds of shows online. It's quite the archive, so please do check it out. In case you need to be reminded, you're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to go to some music and get Dr. Pippin on the phone. And we are back. On today's program, we are speaking with Dr. John J. Pippin of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We're going to be speaking with him today about the Animals in Research and Alternatives Conference that's happening in Washington, D.C. in August. But a bit of background info about Dr. Pippin. Dr. Pippin is a senior medical and research advisor for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, or the PCRM. It's a nationwide organization of physicians and laypersons that promotes preventative medicine, especially good nutrition, and addresses controversies in modern medicine, including ethical and scientific issues in education and research. Dr. Pippin works to promote alternatives to the use of animals in medical and drug research. In 2005, Dr. Pippin testified before the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the Institute of Medicine on how misleading animal experimental results contributed to the approval of Vioxx and other dangerous drugs. He participated in a debate regarding animal research in the UK House of Commons in November 2005. Dr. Pippin also works on PCRM's campaigns to replace medical school animal labs, to end the March of Dimes support of animal research, and many other projects. He contributes research and articles for Good Medicine and serves as a media spokesperson for many of PCRM's efforts. Dr. Pippin, it's my honor to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's great to be back on Animal Voices. Thanks for inviting.
Dr. Pippin, I wanted to talk to you today about the Animals Research and Alternatives Conference that's happening in August. But before we did that, I wanted to give some of our listeners, perhaps listeners who have never heard of the PCRM before, I was wondering if you could give them just a bit of an overview about what is the PCRM and, generally speaking, what does it do?
Well, PCRM, as you mentioned, is the abbreviation for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We're a 501c3 charitable organization founded in 1985 by Dr. Neil Barnard, who is still president of PCRM. Our mission is multifactorial. As you mentioned, we see best practices, and specifically best practices that exclude the use of live animals for research, drug testing, product testing, medical education, trauma training, and those sorts of things. And that is my area of responsibility with PCRM. We also have a toxicology department which deals with the testing of chemicals and toxins and works quite a bit with the EPA and international agencies in that regard. And we have a very prominent nutrition program that focuses in a lot of areas, including best dietary practices. So we have a division called the Cancer Project, which focuses on the role of lifestyle and food choices in the risks for cancer and in persons who already have cancer. And as you know, there's an abundance of literature from just the last 5 years or so on the role of diet and lifestyle in the prevention of certain cancers and in the treatment of certain cancers. So we have kind of a broad reach, but it all focuses around trying to identify and promote best practices in nutrition and in the way we think about animals.
So in August, the PCRM is holding this conference. It's called Animals Research and Alternatives, Measuring Progress 50 Years Later. It's happening in Washington, D.C. Tell our listeners about what happened 50 years ago and why do a conference now to look back on the past 50 years?
Well, 50 years ago is when Russell and Birch developed the notion of what they call the three R's, which is the replacement, reduction, or refinement of the use of animals in medical experimentation. Now, that obviously is very much a welfarist development, but you have to think about it in the context of the time, 50 years ago, and it established the principles that have really become the fundamental principles in medical research, drug testing, and product testing to always seek and take advantage of opportunities to replace the use of animals, to reduce the use of animals by thinking about how you're doing things and not to be wasteful, although I hate to use that term. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about living creatures, and to refine the use of animals, which is defined as developing ways to do the experiments, the research, that are friendlier toward the animals and reduce their distress, pain, suffering, the notion being if animals are used in experimentation or research, that it should be done in a thoughtful manner and as little as possible. The point of 50 years later, using this as a taking off point for the conference in August, is to show, first of all, how much things have changed in the last half century in all of the areas that Russell and Birch talked about, and specifically to bring speakers to the attendees who look at this from a variety of viewpoints, from the ethological viewpoint, that is the study of animal behavior. So we have, of course, we have a much better understanding of what animals go through, what sentience truly means, pain, suffering, fear, anxiety, psychological damage, and so on. And also to look at it from the scientific point of view, specifically looking at ways that maybe using animals for experimentation has not been productive, looking at ways that the old paradigm that animals are small versions of humans and that we can learn by using animals what will happen when we do things with humans, and also looking at, I don't want to use the word alternatives because alternatives implies that the methods we have are okay, are not okay. So let's just say updating the attendees on replacements for the use of animals in all these various ways. So on the one hand, it's an acknowledgement that this is what happened 50 years ago. This was the state of the art at that time. This was quite an innovative concept at that time. And yet a half century later, we are so far advanced that we should really be looking at this as not three R's, but one R, and that one R is replacement.
When you go to the PCRM website, not specifically looking for this conference, but just in general, there's obviously a focus on doing good science. How one would define that, I suppose, is probably not my area of expertise, what good science is, but there's definitely an emphasis on good science, but there's also an emphasis on compassion. And I imagine that for a layperson coming to the website, they may think, well, is this an organization whose mission is based on compassion, or is it based on good science? And I guess I'm leading towards a devil's advocate question of, don't we need to test on animals, and why? You mentioned that you think these tests, that it's not about finding alternatives, but actually replacing these types of tests. Why, in your opinion, do you think these tests are inadequate? Why is your focus on replacement as opposed to refinement and reduction?
I'm happy to answer that. Let me go back to something you said earlier in your comment. Is PCRM an organization concerned with how animals are treated, or is PCRM an organization that is concerned with eliminating the use of animals for these purposes we've been talking about? And the answer is both. It's a false dichotomy that many people in the public have, thinking that, well, you can't combine the ethical issues and the scientific issues, you have to take one side or the other. And that's based on the false assumption that those two aspects of the problem are not in concert. And our whole point is, yes, they are. Science tells us that the use of animals for many of the ways we use them in research, in medical education, in trauma training, in product testing, in drug testing, has been really a terrible failure documented over decades, and that it's past time to replace this approach, this failed paradigm, regardless, really, of how one feels about the ethics of it. We do have an ethical footprint, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But even for those who don't, even for people in your listening audience who say, well, look, if we're not going to use animals for these purposes, I want to know that there's a reason why we're not going to do it, because I don't really care what the animals go through when this happens to them. So our comment is, well, we think you should care what the animals go through, but beside that, the scientific argument is so compelling that it's in our own best interest to switch, and we are switching slowly, from the use of animals to the use of more human-based methods. And by that, I don't mean using people to do the kind of testing that we do on animals, but there are other ways of approaching this that give us better answers. And the problem is, we're trying to overcome a paradigm that is five decades old and that now has become entrenched. It's a huge industry in the United States. Universities count on the funding of this kind of research. There are many private facilities that do this kind of research. The NIH has a $30 billion budget, a substantial portion of which is spent for experiments that include animals. And there's kind of a house of cards that could potentially collapse if this is not done in a gradual, forward-looking manner.
Hmm.
But the short answer to your question is, this is, thank goodness, a situation where the ethical argument and the scientific argument point in the same direction.
I wanted to ask you, I guess, a more personal question, because I've spoken with some people who are involved in science now or who are involved in medicine in different capacities, and I've spoken with a couple of them about sort of their discomfort as they went through school, having to either do animal tests or have to refuse to do animal tests and that sort of thing. Was there ever a time when you supported animal testing, and how did your opinion change if it was sort of a journey from one position to the other?
Well, that's a great question. You're putting some context to this, and I think that's a good thing to do. Yes, the answer to your question is, as I went through my medical training, just like virtually everyone else, I was indoctrinated into the viewpoint that using animals is perhaps an unfortunate but certainly a necessary thing to do to understand human diseases and to develop treatments for human diseases. I believed that. I've always had a heart for animals, but my commitment to helping people was so strong that I did what many scientists do, which is compartmentalize that part of your work so that you don't let it cripple you, so mm-hmm. that you can go ahead, you can proceed. And at all times, of course, you're as kind and humane as you can be. But I'll tell you, no matter what people say, in the very best labs, in the very best institutions, in the very best hands, using animals for medical experimentation is cruel beyond what the general public could even understand. It's horrible, just by the nature of it. So yes, I did have an epiphany. I was doing research using animals, specifically dogs. I'm a cardiologist, and I was doing heart research using dogs. And I realized as I went through that, that what I was doing really was more for me and my career than it was for pushing ahead the science that was going to help patients with heart disease or help prevent people from getting heart disease. So I started looking at it more critically, and I looked at the work my colleagues were doing in a very fine research institution, Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. And in the literature in my field, cardiology, I got control of that literature, and I understood that what was going on in our lab, in the large sense, was going on everywhere. That the research was focused on learning things, but the things we were learning, although they were interesting, and although they maybe had something to do with the dogs or the rats or the pigs that we were using, it really didn't have anything to do with people. You had to start all over again once you thought you learned something in animals and do it all over again in people. And that's, in fact, what I did. I had to take what I learned, and I had to start all over again in people. So I looked at that, and I said, you know, it's hard to admit this, but I'm a fraud. What I'm doing because I'm scientific and inquisitive, and I want a good career, and I'd like to have respect for my colleagues. But when I look down the road, there's really nothing there for people who have heart disease. And I also had dogs of my own at home. And with this epiphany that I had, I would come home, I'd look at my dogs, and I would say, these are dogs who mean the world to me. There's nothing I wouldn't do for them. And yet, every day I get up and go into my lab and I kill dogs. And I'm not proud of it, but that's what I did. And the only difference between my dogs and the dogs in my lab is my dogs got lucky. And that should not be the basis on which animals either have safe and secure and loving homes, or whether they get sliced up and used for medical experiments. So I had to give it up. It blew up my career. The whole notion of avoiding cognitive dissonance was at work, and I clearly was not living my life according to my personal ethics. So I gave it up. Fortunately, I was able to take the grant money that I had and begin doing research in patients with heart disease. But that was my epiphany, and ever since then, that was 1987, ever since then, I have tried to stay up with that border zone between animal experimentation and human benefit so that I can speak with some knowledge and some authority about what works and what doesn't. And what I've learned over the last more than two decades is the paradigm itself is failed. It's false. And fortunately now, although it takes a long time and it moves slowly, a lot of other people who make decisions about that sort of thing are beginning to agree. The National Research Council, the Institute of Medicine, the Science Board of the FDA have all developed statements and recommendations for replacing the use of animals for certain kinds of research and using in vitro and human-based methods. So we are getting there. This was a radical idea in the past. It's no longer a radical idea, and that's why a conference like the one we're having in D.C. in August is very timely because the public needs to understand and investigators in the field need to understand that we are straddling that threshold between an animal-based research paradigm and a human-based research paradigm. And again, I'm going to say that doesn't mean we cut open and do things to people. It means mm-hmm. we use methods that are more predictive of what happens in people than the animal methods are. So that was my journey, and it was quite a rude awakening. You might imagine when you mm-hmm. prepare yourself in medical school and in your postgraduate training for a certain career, and you look up one day and you say, well, you know, I'm a fake, I'm a fraud, I'm not really doing what I think I'm doing, then it's a hard decision to just stop and go in another direction. But fortunately, more scientists are doing that. I think some very good people who maybe had contemplated that kind of career are pursuing careers in better types of research, human-based research. So step by slow, agonizing step, we're moving in that direction.
Dr. Pippin, I really want to thank you for sharing that story and providing some context for our listeners. We need to take a very, very short break, and then when we come back, I want to keep the conversation going about the Animals Research and Alternatives Conference in D.C. in August, as well as talk to you a little bit about the sort of international animal research scene. I read a story on the news segment of this program a couple weeks back about a very, very large primate facility opening up in Malaysia, and I wanted to get your opinion or viewpoint as to why these types of things happen, and what does that mean for alternatives to animal research here. So if you'd like to stick around, I would very much appreciate it.
Sure, you bet.
Today we are speaking with Dr. John J. Pippin from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We're speaking with him about the Animals Research and Alternatives Conference happening in D.C. in August, as well as animal research more generally. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Before the break, we were speaking with Dr. John J. Pippin from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine about his journey with animal testing and the opposition to animal testing for both scientific and ethical, sort of compassionate reasons, I guess you could say. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Pippin back to the program.
Thank you.
Dr. Pippin, I wanted to ask you, because I looked at the list of sponsors for the event, and it's interesting, it includes very large and well-respected universities. And I imagine that these universities, in addition to having departments or committees that are seeking to replace or abolish or at the very least reduce animals in research, I imagine that they also have quite large research facilities. I'm just curious to know, how mainstream is opposition to animal research in the academy and the desire to find an alternative? Is that something that's common to most universities? One of the sponsors is Johns Hopkins Medical School. That is a fairly large university that I'm assuming does quite a bit of animal testing as well.
Yeah, and George Washington University is another sponsor, and the same thing is true. As you know, and as your listeners know, in any large comprehensive university, you're going to find every viewpoint on every topic, really. The whole principle of universities is they don't, or they shouldn't, operate on dogma, but on debate. So while it's true that both Johns Hopkins and George Washington have extensive animal research programs in medicine, it's also true that each of them has pathways that the faculty and other people can follow to, in a respectful manner, not in a combative manner, try to move in the other direction. And that, frankly, is what the Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing at Johns Hopkins is all about. And Thomas Hartung, who's the director of CAT, former director of ECVAM, which was the European organization that promoted the development of replacements for animal testing, that's very much what they do, and they approach it in a scientific manner, much as we've been talking about. So, yes, they do coexist. Yes, there are opportunities to have the opposing viewpoint. It still is very much the default position side, it's not at all uncommon now for people on faculties of universities in the U.S. and especially in Europe to work vigorously in a direction that is inconsistent with what other people in their universities are doing. And that's a good thing, and it's helped move us along. The other side of the coin, I'll tell you, is I know that there are many more people, professionals, physicians, scientists, who would like to do, say, the sorts of things that I'm doing, which is to speak publicly and to try to draw attention to this issue, but cannot do so because their employment would be at risk. So on the one hand, vigorous debate is encouraged. On the other hand, what universities might consider, I don't want to use the word subversive, but what they might consider behaviors that put their research functions in a bad light, that will get you fired. So there's much more below the surface. And at PCRM, we work with a lot of doctors and scientists around the country who help us in various ways who cannot go public.
I guess the subject that we're kind of talking around is this idea that animal testing is an industry, and it's a very, very big industry. And like other industries, I think when regulations come into place or, you know, there might be opposition to a particular practice, you know, other industries, they decide to go offshore. You know, shoe companies might outsource their work to China, or some other company might, you know, move to a country that has worse environmental regulations to be able to do their work without any restriction. And I was mentioning before this huge primate research facility opening up in Malaysia that was just announced a couple weeks ago. Not even 6 months ago, there was an announcement of a large animal testing facility opening up in Puerto Rico. I'm wondering if you see these things as part of the larger animal research industry, and is this just globalization functioning in this milieu as well?
Yeah, it is. This is the way the industry, animal experimentation and the use of animals for product and drug testing, can say to the progressive side, if you squeeze us too hard, we'll go around you. So, as you know, all of these things you're talking about would not happen unless there was an economic incentive for them to happen. So what's happening in the United States, NIH has ended its breeding program of primates and is no longer producing primates that they will then use for NIH-funded research. They have retired many of these non-human primates to sanctuaries, and it's becoming very, very difficult for researchers in America to get chimpanzees, other great apes, and monkeys, New World or Old World monkeys, to do their experiments on. So that's why these things pop up in Puerto Rico, in Malaysia. The Puerto Rico facility, by the way, is quite a battleground now. This is going through the courts, and it has not been built, and there's a great deal of opposition in Puerto Rico to this. And as you might imagine, the proponents of this, from government on down, make economic arguments. In keeping up with this as time goes on, and PCRM has been involved in this, you don't see much of the scientific argument. You would expect them to say, oh, well, it's necessary to use these animals to do research to help humans, but I haven't seen that. What I've seen is this would be a great economic boon to this area of Puerto Rico. We need to do it, as if these animals were not living sentient creatures, but widgets or something, disposable.
So it's not an economic incentive in the sense that the companies are saying, well, we need to go here because it's cheaper.
Well, sure. No, it is. It is. But specifically addressing the issue of where are they getting the primates, they can import them, and that's under the jurisdiction of Fish and Wildlife in the U.S. government. And when these facilities pop up different places, you know, China is a big provider, Indonesia, Puerto Rico wants to become a big provider. What they do is they capture these animals from indigenous forests, they keep them in cages, they breed them, some of them breed them, some of them don't, and then they trade them for money. It's a business. And this is how a lot of universities and companies, you know, there are 8 major primate centers in the U.S., this is one way they get their animals because it's now not possible to get those animals through the NIH because they've stopped their breeding program, and they're sending a lot of their animals to sanctuary. So, yes, they can still get funding for primate research. NIH will still throw money at it. They just won't give you the animals to do it. So they want to get the animals. The best way to get them is to deal with locations that do not have laws and regulations governing that sort of thing, and where it can be done cheaply. And that's the same reason, to go on to your second point, why drug testing and a lot of the animal research is very questionable, has been outsourced to other countries where there are not well-developed animal protection movements. It's just a good business decision on the part of the company. And foremost among those, by the way, are the pharmaceutical companies, the drug companies.
Mm-hmm. Thinking back to the conference that's going to be happening in D.C., it sounds like a lot of the issues that we've been discussing, especially these last few minutes, are issues of policy, you know, limiting perhaps where research facilities in the U.S. can get their animals from or how they can outsource their work. Is influencing policy part of what this conference is about, and will policymakers, you think, attend?
Well, good question. Certainly the information available in this conference is exactly the kind of information you would use as you consider policy issues. A good example is GAPA, the Great Ape Protection Act, which is in the House of Representatives now. It's an act which would end, over a period of just a few years, the use of great apes, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, bonobos, so on, for research and product testing and drug testing in the U.S., and would also ban the breeding of these great apes in the U.S. Now, that would go, obviously, a very long way toward addressing just what you asked about. As with any kind of measure that is that restrictive and any kind of measure that is perceived to be impeding the ability of researchers to do what they want to do, you know, the holy grail of medical research where not enough questions are asked, that's very hard to get done. We've been pleasantly surprised by the amount of legislative support GAPA has attained. There are more than 140 co-sponsors of this legislation now in the House of Representatives. And as a first step, getting this through the House of Representatives would be a practical victory, but it also would be a symbolic victory in the sense that even 5 years ago, you could never have gotten a measure like this even out of committee. So that's how far we've come. And you know, that's clearly a policy issue, you know, legislation that's pending and has strong support in the House of Representatives. And one of the arguments that pushes this is the United States is the only country on the planet that does invasive research on great apes, chimpanzees, and the great apes. Let me correct that. The only country on Earth that does invasive research on chimpanzees. There are a few others that do some on some other great apes. So this is a situation where policy and practice ought to be hand in hand. Nobody else finds it necessary to do this. It's prohibited in the UK. It's prohibited in the European Union. It's the progressive way to go. Their science is not suffering from the fact that they can't lock these near-human creatures up for 40, 50 years, their entire lives. And as a policy matter, this is a big step. And that's one leg on the stool, obviously, is policy, a law, regulation. Another leg on the stool is public awareness of what's going on. And maybe the third leg on the stool is a gradual understanding in the scientific community that there are other, in fact, better ways to do this.
Dr. Pippin, we're down to the last 2 minutes or so of the program. I want to thank you so much for being on the program and for providing so much of the great information that you've provided. I wanted to ask you, as we sort of whittle down the last 2 minutes, if you could tell us a little bit about where people can find more information about the Animals Research and Alternatives Conference happening in August in D.C., and where they can find maybe more info about the PCRM. Is the conference something that lay people can sort of keep tabs on, and will they more or less understand what's going on, or is this kind of a heady discussion that's going to take place on a fairly high academic level?
Well, it's a little of both. A lot of the speakers are going to address issues that will be familiar and easily understandable by the non-scientific public, and some of the rest of it is going to focus on methods that have been developed that can replace the use of animals and so on, such as the use of human tissue and simulation and a variety of other things. So it's kind of a mixture. The target audience is anyone who has that level of interest and just sort of a basic fundamental understanding of what the issues are. It's taking place at the Washington Marriott, which is on 22nd Street Northwest, August 26th and 27th. And the best way to get information on this is to go to the PCRM website, which is www.pcrm.org, and right there on the homepage is a big link to the Animals Research and Alternatives Conference. Just click on that, and you can see the speakers, the topics, the location, the agenda, everything. And then when you get through doing that, just click back to the homepage, and you can learn a lot about what PCRM is doing, who the players are, what some of our campaigns are. You see some of our nutritional programs. You'll see our effort to stop NASA doing radiation experiments on two-pound squirrel monkeys, and a variety of other things. And we welcome interested people to join us in supporting our work, because we're really the one organization that goes at this from the medical and scientific expertise viewpoint. We always bring that to the table, and that's something that really is unique for PCRM.
Dr. Pippin, I want to thank you once again for being on the program and for bringing your perspective to the table. Again, as you're saying, it's one thing to debate these issues in terms of compassion or ethics, but it's a whole other thing to debate them on scientific merits. And I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge as well as your personal stories.
Glad to have the opportunity to speak to your audience. I know your audience tunes in because they care about these things, and anything we can do to give them a better understanding, we're just delighted to have the opportunity to do it. And again, I'll urge people to go to the PCRM website, and you'll learn a lot more about what we're up to.
And we will make sure to add a link to our website when the show is posted online on our website, www.animalvoices.ca. Thanks so much, Dr. Pippin, and take care.
Thank you very much.
Bye. We were just speaking with Dr. John J. Pippin from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine about the upcoming Animals Research and Alternatives Conference happening in August in D.C. I will definitely be keeping tabs on it and bringing more information about it to you listeners out there. Thanks so much for listening to the program. Do check out our website, over 300 shows archived online, www.animalvoices.ca. And coming up next is DJ Chris, CIUT 89.5.